This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Nearly 2 years ago, Governor Peter Shumlin devoted his entire State of the State address to the problem of opiate addiction and the surge of heroin entering Vermont. He talked about the enormous increase in deaths attributed to addiction, how about 80% of inmates jailed in Vermont were facing drug-related charges, and the governor addressed the need for more treatment centers and a greater understanding of addiction as a disease. The spotlight the governor placed on opiate addiction rippled throughout the state and the country, and it did lead to an increase in treatment availability and a redirecting of state funds. But last week on this program, we talked about where things stand with heroin and addiction. Detective Lieutenant John Merrigan, who commands the Vermont State Police Narcotics Investigation Unit, struck a pretty dire note.
We're doing a much better job at working together, at working with our federal partners here in Vermont to identify the traffickers and prosecute them more effectively than we have ever done before. But at the same time, there's more heroin here in Vermont today than there was 6 months ago. And 6 months ago, there was more heroin in Vermont than there was 6 months before that. So it's definitely an uphill battle.
An uphill battle for sure, and one that is not easy to solve. But Governor Shumlin has just over a year left in his job as the state's chief executive. And today on the program, we're going to ask him how he plans to address that problem. We'll talk with him about a whole host of other issues as well. Governor Peter Shumlin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's so great to be with you.
Okay, so on heroin and opiate addiction, tell me first where you think we have made progress.
We've made huge progress in, first of all, changing attitudes towards the disease. Let's be honest about this. We discriminated against anybody who was opiate addict, heroin addict. We have, as a Vermont family, and I'm so proud of Vermonters, finally acknowledged that this is our daughters and sons, our moms and dads, our grandparents, and this is, we're all in this one together, and it should be treated exactly like kidney disease, cancer, or anything else. Second, we have changed. We were badly blowing the way we were dealing with folks who were suffering from this disease, and we were literally saying, you know, we're going to throw you in jail or we're going to throw the law enforcement system at you and somehow think we're going to make progress, and we just haven't. So now we're saying, if you will go into treatment, if you will get the take the wraparound services that you desperately need, get back to work, become a productive member of society, no court, no judge, no criminal record. I mean, that's very radical and extraordinary stuff. It's real criminal justice reform. And finally, we stopped saying, if you have this disease, we're not going to spend the resources to fix it because we don't think it's as important as other diseases. So get in line. You know, I often recite the story of my own dad who passed away from cancer about a year and a half ago. And when he got his diagnosis, the doctor said, you know, this is a result of a life choice you made. You were a smoker, it's not an inherited disease in this case or an inherited cancer. And, you know, the system, we didn't say to my dad, hey, you know, you made some life choices that have left you in this situation. Get in line. They're not going to treat you. They're not going to help you. Just line up. We do that with opiate addiction. So I'm proud that we've built out a delivery system, the hub and spoke system in Vermont, where we're finally giving treatment to folks that need it. Now, experts will tell you out there in the field, we still have lines. That's true. And as Lieutenant Merrigan just said, that's because we got more people using.
Well, and how do you think we should address that? Because we can't spend our way out of this problem. We can't build enough treatment centers, even if we had the money, have enough diversion programs, offer enough medication-assisted therapy to spend our way out of this problem if we're not addressing how much opium and heroin is coming into the state and that people continue to get addicted or to stay addicted. So how do you think we should target that pinch point?
I have very strong feelings about that, and let's not forget this is not a Vermont problem. This is a national problem, and now we've got presidential candidates talking about partnering with us to solve it. We've got New Hampshire and our neighboring states all going suddenly, wow, we got a problem a couple of years after Vermont came up to the plate. Having said that, listen, let's just look at the raw facts. How do we get into this mess? Why do we have so many folks in America buying heroin and using it and becoming addicted? And the answer is that we, when we legalized, started selling to our drugstores, FDA-approved legal OxyContin and other painkillers, and we started handing it out with irrational exuberance, we created an opiate addiction chain that is what we have now today. And just look at the numbers. In 2010, just think about this for a minute. 2010, we prescribed enough OxyContin to keep every adult in America high for a month. In 2012, we prescribed 250 million doses of OxyContin prescriptions. I mean, that's how many people we have. So it was a prescription for every single person in America. This is crazy stuff. In 2010, Purdue, the manufacturer, pleaded guilty to deceiving, lying to doctors and providers when this drug came out and convincing them that it wasn't addictive when it was, and they paid a $67 million fine. Well, guess what? They made, that year, $11 billion selling OxyContin. So what's a $67 million fine? Here's my point. Until the FDA partners with us to have a real conversation about pain in America and stops passing this stuff out like candy, we will continue to have a heroin problem in America. That is just that simple.
But heroin is cheaper. So even if we tackle the problem now of prescription opiates, we have a whole host of people who are addicted and who can find cheaper heroin on the street than they could trying to get a prescription in some way from a doctor or stealing from people's medicine cabinets.
That's correct. But we have to ask, how did that happen? We used to have an OxyContin addiction problem or a painkiller addiction problem. Now it's pure heroin. But why? Well, we were smart. I mean, we thought we were smart. We took the OxyContin that we're handing out like candy. We made it tamper resistant. So if you crush it, it turns to gel. You can't shoot it. You can't snort it. It also became very valuable on the street to find the non-crushable stuff. So folks can buy this poison pure in the form of heroin in cities for $5 a bag. It costs about $20 a bag in Vermont. Huge incentive to bring it, 3-4 hours up the highway and sell it up here. I mean, try find a business model that good. $5 for $20, just riding it in the car. So, but my point is, this problem isn't created by drug dealers from South America coming up here and selling us this junk. It really isn't. It's created by our approach to painkillers. And when we get folks addicted to painkillers, they then turn to the most cheaper opiate, which is heroin. If we could solve that, fundamentally, that's our problem. It's not the illegal drugs. That's obviously a problem. It's the legal drugs that we're handing out with irrational exuberance that we didn't used to, and we all survived. And we've got to have a conversation. I'll give you an example. One of my folks who works hard for my team ran into one of his kids who just had 4 molars taken out. And I always do this now. I said, how many painkillers did you get? She said, 60. I said, how many do you use? She said, half of one. I mean, what are we doing?
We're talking today with Governor Peter Shumlin. Right now, we're looking at this question of addiction, specifically opiate addiction. As we heard in a clip from Detective Lieutenant Merrigan a few minutes ago, it is not stemmed in Vermont, despite all of the efforts, despite all of the attention that's been paid. He says he's seeing more heroin coming into the state now than 6 months ago, more than 6 months before that. If you want to talk about that, or if you'd like to ask another question of the governor, we're going to talk about energy policy, solar siting. We're going to talk about education policy. And we're also going to connect the dots in just a moment here between the opiate addiction problem and what we're seeing in the Department for Children and Families. If you'd like to weigh in, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Penny, who's calling in from Berkshire. Hi, Penny. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to address the fact of opiate addiction. I am an addict who is in treatment right now. And the biggest thing that addicts face is treatment. We don't have the resources that we need. I attend a group for addicts, and most of them aren't in treatment, and they're begging to get into treatment. We just don't have the places that we need to go to receive this. Maybe once a week we can go to a clinic that the residents are kind of fighting. They don't want it, but that would lower the crime rate. We just need more resources.
Yeah,
Penny, we need more doctors to prescribe Suboxone.
Yeah, how far away is your closest clinic?
So I'm in Berkshire, so my clinic, the closest would be in Burlington, but fortunately I do have a doctor, mm-hmm. but 90% of people that I know can't find one. They're on a waiting list, and the list are like 100 people before them.
Yep.
So, Governor, you mentioned the lines are still long, the treatment centers are full, more treatment centers come online, more doctors who are allowed, licensed to prescribe buprenorphine, then they still have more people on waiting lists. Penny's addressing this from the perspective of somebody who's living it.
And Penny, thanks for calling in and thanks for your courage. And we're behind you all the way in your recovery. Listen, I mean, what Penny's talking about is the frustration, which is that we have done a beautiful job building out treatment facilities across Vermont. And we really have. We've invested millions and millions of dollars. We've increased our treatment budget in a time when we're cutting budgets. We added $8 million alone last year. We just can't build it out fast enough. And the only good news, so math is simple, as we have, you know, literally every year we're watching our treatment double. So that's what we're up against. So had we, if we didn't have this influx of folks signing up for this disease, getting this disease, we would be doing fine in terms of the treatment. No one anticipated, as Lieutenant Merrigan said on a show a few weeks ago, you know, the kind of influx of folks that we're getting in. So we've got to keep spending. I mean, there's just no other way around it. We've got to keep building out treatment. We're doing that. We've got to, but the biggest challenge we have is finding enough doctors who will serve this population. And I do think that that's one area where we still are facing some challenges. There's a hesitation to have these, you know, addicts in your waiting room. There's a hesitation to deal with a population where they get under reimbursed because many of them are on Medicaid. And we've got a lot more work to do there. We need more providers. Let's take, you know, Penny just mentioned she goes to Burlington. Well, huge waiting list there. They're doing a great job trying to treat the folks they have. I'm working very actively with Mayor Weinberger, with UVM, with everyone that we can get to try open up more facilities there. But it's tough to find docs who already have full caseloads in rural Vermont who can say, hey, I can take this on. So that's what we're up against. And we're going to keep working on it. I'm dedicated to ensuring that we have treatment for everyone that deserves it, just like we would for any other disease. But we are not there yet. Penny's absolutely right.
You think we can get there? You think we have the budget to get there?
We have to have the budget to get there because, as Penny just pointed out, it's much more expensive to not do this. Listen, I just want to give you these numbers because this matters. If you don't have a neighbor or a friend or a family member who's been addicted and therefore your heart isn't in this one, which, I mean, these are great Vermonters who deserve to get into recovery. But forget your heart. Just with your head for a minute, do the math. It costs us $1,130 a week roughly to put a nonviolent addict in jail. A week. That's what we're spending in Vermont. You go to a jail, it's probably now a little higher than that. It's probably more like $1,150 a week. For $123 to $30 a week, we can get you in the program that Penny's talking about. So it's crazy not to. And what's holding us back is the resources, the providers, the docs, the nurses, some of the federal regulations that don't allow people to treat. So we've got plenty of obstacles, but we've got to do it. And it's penny wise and pound foolish not to. It's also heartless.
While we're talking on this subject, let's take a few more calls from listeners who have thoughts on it. Jay is on the line with us from Chelsea. Hi, Jay. Go ahead.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my call, Jane and Governor Shumlin. I'm concerned because it seems all three states here, Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, are all talking about the heroin opioid situation as if it's a problem. And I think it's actually just a symptom of a much larger and greater problem, whether people are using heroin, OxyContin, alcohol, sugar-sweetened beverages. They seem to be searching for something, for some type of euphoria, for some type of relief from the oppression of a very, very corrupt, unequal society that has really made things just ever, ever increasingly worse. And I think as long as you keep talking about solving this problem as a symptom rather than dealing with the actual problem, it's only going to continue to get worse. There are so many other misnomers. The biggest problem with the OxyContin overdoses, I think if you were to actually be honest about them, and some people are, is because people do not find the euphoria in the OxyContin that they want, so they use alcohol with it. It's a very deadly combination to use barbiturates. Any type of barbiturates with alcohol and OxyContin is certainly a barbiturate. This is not stressed enough, and that's certainly a problem there. This fentanyl problem now, you know, I would really like to see the state of Vermont or the government of the United States intercept the shipment coming into this country, because nobody is making heroin in this country. No one is making fentanyl in this country. It's coming from overseas somewhere. And the largest producer of opium and heroin in the world is from Afghanistan.
Jay, your line cut out there. I appreciate what you're saying, and I appreciate you making the point about addiction as a larger societal issue. And certainly there are a lot of contributing factors in a lot of what we've been talking about and what we'll continue to talk about, including poverty, including a sense of desperation in some cases, not in all cases. But I appreciate your point. I want to get another voice in here before we return to the governor. Jean is calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jean. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you, and thank you so much, Governor Shumlin, for bringing this crisis to the attention of the people of Vermont and the people in the United States. I was very curious about the opioid prescription problem. I know four addicts personally, and none of them were prescribed a prescription medication. For those people, it was very much like our last caller, who talked about a deeper societal problem. And for each one of the individuals that I know, there was, I would say, there was a problem of very low self-esteem, which came from some family history of alcoholism, just in general, not, you know, undereducated in our Vermont school systems, and not able to get a good job. And others that just were not recognized at a very early, and another person that wasn't recognized at a very early age mm-hmm. as having some sort of depressive tendencies.
Jean, so it's interesting that you're building on what Jay said there and talking about societal pressures and people looking for something else. And I want to direct our conversation a little bit, Governor, to what we've heard from people in the Department for Children and Families, which is that they've been seeing an increase in the number of cases reported of abuse and neglect, and they are attributing that to drug addiction. They've also frequently said to us, you know, this is a problem, but it is a symptom of a larger problem, much as Jay and Jean were saying, that some of these symptoms come from other problems that we're having. And I'd like you to address that question of the Department for Children and Families, certainly in August with the murder of DCF worker Lara Sobel. It really shined a light on the work that DCF is doing and also on the real hatred in some parts of Vermont for DCF workers and understandable frustration in some cases, but certainly, you know, murder is beyond the pale, beyond that level of frustration. There have been bills that have been passed that are attempting to deal with the issue of child abuse and neglect. But the bill that passed in the last legislative session didn't add more funding for the department, which is dealing with the repercussions of some of these societal ills that we've been talking about. Will you push for more funding in the upcoming session?
So let me, I mean, Jean and Jay and you have all, you know, raised some really important issues. Let's just try to hit them both, all of them. First of all, DCF and the funding. It's important to know that I increased the funding for DCF and the legislature supported me and we added positions. So, and
we have increased the funding, but not enough to add the number of positions that the citizen review boards would suggest are needed for DCF to do the work that
may well be. But the citizen review board, you know, we can have that. We will have that debate until we cows come home. We've got more work to do, no question about it. We'll be coming out with a package that continues to address this problem. But let's go to the root. First of all, we all know that addiction is driven by the kind of things that are holding back America right now, which is huge frustration, hopelessness, a sense, particularly for low-income folks, that they're worse off than they were before, middle-class folks that aren't seeing their incomes go up for years and years. That's frustration. And there's lots of reasons leading to all kinds of addiction. But I hope that we don't lose sight of the following. Number one, there is a correlation, even though in Jean's case, she knows four addicts who didn't get in on OxyContin and painkillers. I can tell you that the statistics prove that a huge majority of heroin addicts will tell you that they got in originally because of painkillers. They had a broken hip, they had a car accident, they had whatever it was, and it led them into this challenge. So that's just what the evidence suggests. And there's just no disputing the fact that we didn't have the heroin problem in Vermont or in America before we started passing out painkillers with our irrational exuberance. I mean, you can track it. So the statistics prove that it's a slightly different conversation than just the overall addiction problem, hopelessness, helplessness that we're all feeling. Second, on the question of what we do about the bigger problems, listen, that's what I've spent the last 5 years working so hard on. We're making real progress, and that's what I'm going to spend the next year working so hard on. What have we done? I mean, we sometimes, you know, beat ourselves so hard with the old willow stick that we don't pause and say, wait, how are we doing compared to the rest of this country? We now in Vermont are the only state in America, because of the work we've done, that ensures that 3- and 4-year-olds have access, every single one of them if they choose, to high-quality early childhood education. And if we don't think that that work that we do when the brain is forming is the most important work that we're doing with kids to make sure that they have a bright future, we're just not getting it. Second, we've made huge changes in the educational enterprise so that it's not just people that were born with mountains of opportunity that have huge hope. We now have individualized work plans for every kid. You can now get 2 free years of college in Vermont if you play your cards right. You can now literally get job training on the job that will take you places if you're on reach up that you couldn't have gotten before, where you're getting the training for a good job that moves you forward. And I've met many reach up folks who've succeeded in that and are now managing other people in the workforce because of their success. We have moved to an energy policy that's created extraordinary jobs, 16,000 jobs in Vermont in the green energy sector, because we have 10 times the number of solar panels that we had when I came on. We've got wind, we've got renewables, we're doing energy efficiency right. And guess what? We're the only state in the region that saw power rates go down over the last 3 years, when all the critics, when I shut down Vermont Yankee, said, helped to shut down Vermont Yankee, said, oh, our power rates are going to go through the roof and it's going to kill us and the lights are going to go off. Well, we're the only state where we've actually seen power rates go down. What else have we done? We've got 13,000 new jobs. We are really making progress in a number of sectors because of our policies. So my point is, we got to pause sometimes in this little state and say, hey, you know, we're doing an awful lot of great things right. And we're not going to beat national trends. We're not going to divorce ourselves from the problems of the other 49 states. But at least we have the courage as a state to take on the really important things: early child education, quality education, making sure that we have the programs in place that help out low-income Vermonters, a decent minimum wage, you know, paid sick days that we're working for now. So, we're the first state in the country to have, if you qualify for federal meals in schools, every kid gets it. You don't pay a dime, which means, you know, no kid goes to school hungry anymore. We're doing criminal justice reform right. We're doing driver restoration days. I mean, I can give you the litany of things, but sometimes we forget to pause and say, hey, wait a minute. As Vermont's a lot better off than an awful lot of states, which is why we have one of the lowest unemployment rates in America, and why our employers are now saying, unlike when I became governor, when they were doing layoffs, hey, Gov, we need more employers. We need more workers. If you could get us them, we could grow, not contract.
We're going to talk more about some of the issues that the governor just raised, including education, although we're going to talk more about Act 46, which is the mechanism that the state is using to encourage school districts to merge into larger districts. We're also going to talk about solar siting projects in the energy sector and other questions that you have. We certainly can, we have, and we will again focus on opiate addiction for a whole show, but we're going to move on from that topic now and look at some of the other things that the governor is dealing with and other questions that you have for him. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note, carry on this conversation we've been having right now on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking all hour with Governor Peter Shumlin. And if you have a question for him about health care costs as we continue with the open enrollment time period for Vermont Health Connect, or about his views on what kinds of rights towns should have in solar energy project siting, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Liam who says, can the governor please address the current situation with the state mental health system and emergency room wait times for beds? This is another medical population, like addicts, historically treated like they have social or legal problems. Emergency rooms treat the medically ill and house the mentally ill. We can do better. The governor's made a great start at the new hospital in Berlin, but the job is far from done.
Absolutely, the job is far from done. But I just got to tell you how proud I am of what we've gotten done. We had our acute care facility get wiped out in Irene. We had hundreds of patients where nowhere to go. We had a hospital that had been condemned by the federal government for 10 years. Vermonters paid $10 million a year out of their own pockets because we weren't getting the federal match, because the Fed said that facility is such a mess that we won't certify it. So we kind of inherited a little bit of a challenge here. I'm proud to say that we've built state-of-the-art mental health facilities in Berlin, in Brattleboro, and in Rutland. And we are building out our mental health, community mental health system so that it reduces the need for acute care. Now, listen, we've always had challenges in hospital waiting rooms. We had more because of the crisis we were managing. We're slowly seeing those numbers go down. We've got more work to do. But I continue to be committed to treating mental health like every other disease, to making sure that we have a bed for everybody. And I've just got to point out again, if while we have challenges, if you compare us to other states who also have huge backlogs in their hospital waiting rooms, much longer than ours in most cases, including over in New Hampshire, and you look at the way they're treating critically ill patients, Vermont now has state-of-the-art facilities that most states would envy to have.
I want to move from treatment to payment and insurance. It's open enrollment season around the country for healthcare insurance policies. Are you satisfied with the performance of Vermont Health Connect, the healthcare exchange website that we're using in Vermont, which underwent pretty massive revamping prior to the open enrollment season?
I continue to be cautiously optimistic that we finally built the website that we wished we'd had 2 years ago. Just to keep this in context, there isn't a governor in America who had to build a website who didn't have huge challenges. Some gave up, some stuck with it. There isn't a president of the United States who didn't continue to have problems with their exchanges. So, you know, big picture, when they passed the Affordable Care Act in Washington, it is my strong belief that the desire to get low-income folks reasonable health care, expand Medicaid, the enthusiasm for doing that was way ahead of the ability of technology companies to make shopping for healthcare like buying a book on Amazon. And that's why so many technology companies, so many governors and the president struggled with this. Having said that, I made a tough decision. Do we give up and go to the federal exchange or do we stick with it? And I said we stick with it for lots of reasons. One is low-income Vermonters get better subsidies for healthcare than the rest of the country, so we would have been really giving them a, you know, screwing them, to be honest. Second, our standards are higher than insurance companies, so we're better off having high standards, making sure that no one gets discriminated against. And finally, you're always better off running your own destiny than dealing with the feds. It's just what history shows us. So, you know, we didn't have very many friends in my administration when we stuck with it. We had Democrats saying it could never be done, it can never be fixed. We had Republicans saying it can never be done, it can never be fixed. We had progressives saying it can never be done, it can never be fixed. And we had independents saying that. And we had lots of Vermonters who were hugely frustrated. We was pretty lonely. We worked incredibly hard. I'm incredibly encouraged that the website is up and running and doing what we hoped it would do. And I'm going to reserve judgment for the next couple of weeks, but it's going very smoothly.
You mentioned low-income Vermonters and what subsidies they receive. I'd like to also talk about low-income Vermonters who are on Medicaid. And let's talk specifically about what it's going to cost Vermont this year for Medicaid. In the FY16 budget, which we're in now, there's a $38 million gap. The expenses are $38 million more than anticipated for Medicaid costs. And the state is going to have to come up with that money in January when the legislature is back and does a budget readjustment. And it looks like another $58 million in the FY17 budget will need to be budgeted for Medicaid costs. Now, you tried to find a measure to close that gap in the last session. Part of your payroll tax proposal would have addressed a little bit of the Medicaid costs in addition to reimbursement. That didn't pass. So do you think we need to find a dedicated revenue source to deal with Medicaid costs in this state so that we're not continually looking at rising costs and looking at these budget gaps?
Absolutely. And until we do, we're going to continue to struggle with a state budget. Let me just do the simple math. You know, when you read some of the accounts or we all talk about this, it sounds like our economy's not doing well, revenues are down, and the budget can't be balanced. The fact of the matter is that every year that I've been governor, revenues have gone up from the mess that we inherited. We've added jobs. The economy's expanded. And the obvious thing is people pay more taxes because we've expanded. We've done that without raising income tax rates, sales tax rates, or rooms and meals tax rates. So revenues are higher than they were every year prior to the budgets I've submitted. So why do we have this problem? We have this problem because we've been really successful at using the Affordable Care Act and all the other tools that Vermonters want us to use to provide universal access to health care. This is one of the least reported stories in Vermont. What's that mean? It means that we compete with Massachusetts for the lowest uninsured rate in America. We're literally down to a little over 3% of Vermonters have no insurance. Everybody else is in. We've accomplished that through a number of means, one of which is expanding Medicaid, which was President Obama's idea and the Democrats' idea when we said we want to do something about health care access. So that's all good news. The problem we have in Vermont is that we expand Medicaid, we add more services, we're always excited about that and doing the right thing, and Vermonters believe in helping out their neighbors, and guess what? We don't raise the money to pay for it. So the reason that this governor, who doesn't like taxes, who hasn't raised income taxes, sales tax, stood up at the podium last January and said, team, we're leaving, think about this, we're leaving $100 million of federal money on the table because we refuse to raise our match for Medicaid as we expand, put more and more Vermonters on it. We now have a third of our state, literally, on some form of Medicaid, over 200,000 Vermonters, almost a third. So my point is, until the legislature and the governor have the courage to raise a dedicated revenue source so that we can pay our providers a fair reimbursement and draw down that federal money that we're leaving on the table, we're going to continue to have to rob every other agency of state government in order to pay for Medicaid expansion. It's foolish. It's irresponsible. It's going to catch up with us. And that's where we are.
Or we restrict eligibility. We stop expanding eligibility for Medicaid and make fewer Vermonters eligible for that, which, as you've said, does increase the cost shift problem and increase the amount that Vermont is paying. So did we go too far in expanding Medicaid eligibility?
Absolutely not. And anyone who suggests that you can solve this problem by returning to a policy that says just don't give folks insurance is being penny-wise, first of all, a little bit heartless, and secondly, penny-wise and pound foolish, because they show up in the emergency rooms, it costs you more. And just like education, we all pay for it, even if it's not. It comes to you via your health insurance premium every single year.
We have more to talk about with Governor Peter Shumlin. We're going to try in the 15 minutes or so we have left to get in education policy and funding and Act 46. We're also going to try to talk about solar siting. And we're going to try to see if we can get the governor to budge on whether or not he'll endorse somebody for his position when he leaves as we enter this election season. And other questions from you. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. And you're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're talking today with Governor Peter Shumlin, and if you have a question for him about how communities can be involved in where solar projects are being sited within their boundaries, or if you want to talk about Act 46, which I should point out we'll also talk about in tomorrow's show, so plenty of time to talk about education funding and district consolidation in tomorrow's program. But if you have questions for the governor on those subjects or others, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments and questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Governor, we got a note from Mark who says, the governor's RESET program establishes renewable energy goals, but turns achievement of those goals over to the energy developers. Developers are abusing towns, and the towns are realizing that they have very little say about energy siting. This has sparked a statewide energy rebellion that's been joined by dozens of towns and a couple of regional planning commissions. Towns across the state are fighting poorly sited projects at the Public Service Board and in the Supreme Court. Wouldn't it be better to meet our goals with the cooperation of towns and instead of letting developers shove unwanted projects down their throats?
You know, I don't buy into or subscribe to the theory that we're somehow ignoring the voices of local communities. And there's more to do for sure. But
I think there are something like 40 towns that have signed on basically saying we need more of a say. We do feel like we're being ignored.
I understand people feel that way. I just want to cite the record here for a sec. We're going through a revolution in energy, thankfully, because it might save our planet. And, you know, I don't know if it's too late or not. It's quite possible that it is. I'll be going to the climate summit in Paris. I'm incredibly committed to this issue. There's nothing more important that's before us. Having said that, the difference is that we used to have energy projects out there somewhere. Now they're going to be in our backyard. Solar, whatever it's going to be, you're going to see it. So it's kind of, I kind of liken it to the era where my very favorite Vermont governor, also from Putney, George D. Aiken, had the job of running power lines at the end of every dirt road. Can you imagine trying to run power lines in Vermont right now? I mean, forget it. You wouldn't get the third pole up, right? So my point is, we're going to see it. It's going to be in our front yards. Let's do it smart. Let's listen to local communities. But in energy siting, we cannot give local communities veto power because no one would have any projects. We wouldn't have energy. And that's always been true. If you know, local communities could say no to any kind of big generating plant, we wouldn't get generation built. So this isn't a new challenge. What's new is that we see our generation we didn't used to, and we need to all accept that and then figure out how to do it right. Having said that, we should partner with local communities. We should continue to listen. We do. I think the Public Service Board does. I think everybody does. Everyone gets a say. It doesn't mean you always get your way, and there's a difference. Now, we have 10 times the number of solar panels we had in Vermont when I became governor. I think we'll double that again in the next year. That's the good news. But we have to do it at a right scale. I absolutely agree with that. I came out against these huge 110-acre, 120-acre, 20-meg systems that are being proposed around Vermont. Why? Because one of the beauties, the reason we're saving money on renewables and actually seeing our rates go down, one of the reasons is that we're avoiding transmission upgrades that we otherwise would have paid because we're doing local grid. So what I believe in is locally grown small energy projects on your roof, in your yard, in your backyard, and not these huge projects. And the reason I say that is because if you take certain parts of the state, we're now we're constricted in terms of being able to transmit that power out to the folks that need it. You'd have to do huge transmission upgrades, as Valco can tell you, to be able to build those out. So we got to do this smart. We got to listen to local communities, but we can't give them veto power. We got to continue to do what we're doing because Vermont is leading in building out renewables and getting off of fossil fuels. And we have to make sure that we do it at a scale that makes sense for Vermont. And that means locally grown, small projects, local grid transmission should be favored over huge mega projects.
Although I suppose small is in the eye of the beholder or large. You've said 20 megawatt power projects that are on about 110 acres of land are too big. A lot of people think 2 megawatt projects on 10 or 11 acres are too big. And so if you're not giving towns veto power, what does it mean to say we need to listen to towns? What would you actually do differently?
Well, I would continue to have each local community have a voice in the public service board process, which they do now, and that's a good thing. But we also listen. We listen to folks who are concerned about projects, and we tend to do things pretty logically in Vermont. So, you know, we're learning as we go. We got a little more learning to do. I'm just saying there's a big difference between listening to local communities and giving local communities veto power. Anyone that gives local communities veto power is really saying, let's not build out renewables anymore. Let's be honest about this. And it's probably would have been true about any generation project in the past. Nothing new about that. But that's why in Vermont historically has never said, whatever the community says goes. They've got to be part of a bigger process because we all need the juice. Secondly, I think that we're learning how to do renewables right. And I really feel strongly that we're getting that. We're listening. We're all working together. We're learning together. We should be proud of the jobs we've created, the cheaper energy we have, the greener energy we have. We've got more work to do. And let's do it together.
Let's talk to Bradley, who's calling in from Waterbury Center. Hi, Bradley. Go ahead.
Governor, I'm just concerned about the speed on the interstate. It seems to be getting faster and faster.
And you'd like to see more enforcement of speed limits?
I very seldom see a state trooper in the interstate anymore.
Thanks for your call. I appreciate that. I see troopers a lot. But Governor Shumlin, what do you think?
Well, you know, this is one of those where, and Bradley raises an important issue where, you know, some folks say we don't see enough of them. Other folks say we see too many of them. We have actually increased the number of state troopers on the road while I've been governor. We've funded the public safety budget as we should. And I think we found the right balance in Vermont. But having said that, Bradley's absolutely right. Like, what is it about this era right now where we seem to have more and more folks out there going 100, 110, 120 miles an hour? This is crazy stuff. And, you know, we can't quite get a handle on what's driving it. But we are increasing patrols on our highways. We are busting these folks, which is why you read about it in the press. And we're punishing them, taking their licenses away, doing all the things we should be doing. But my message is simple. Use your brain. Drive carefully. These are like, you know, little weapons on the road. When you drive a vehicle 90, 100, 110 miles an hour, you're not only going to kill yourself, but you're likely to kill some other innocent Vermonter. It's not okay.
I want to talk a little bit about Act 46. Now, this is the bill that encourages school districts and supervisory unions to merge and create larger education districts, about an average of 900 students. Eventually, the state will have the power to force mergers if towns aren't doing this on their own. We have a couple of notes that I'll read you. Heather in Lake Elmore says, how will the State Board of Education and the Secretary of Education help school choice towns like the town of Elmore, who was the first to vote down a merger with a neighboring non-school choice town? town. How will you help us comply with Act 46? If school consolidation is truly up to the electorate of a town and democracy truly exists, how can the taxpayers in Elmore be penalized through the variable cap on school spending for retaining their school choice and exceptional educational outcomes? How can school choice in tuition towns both be protected and denied with a merge? And David says, my town has a freestanding school district that runs an outstanding elementary school for 100 students. We combined with a neighboring town in a separate district for a middle and high school. School administrators know that they are being watched carefully and held accountable for their actions. School board meetings are well attended. Voters scrutinize budget proposals and insist on efficient spending and high-quality results. David goes on to say the school consolidation bill should be repealed and more attention given to the supervisory unions, helping them find ways to support their component districts with more sharing of administrative and educational services that can save money and improve educational results. So a couple citizens there sharing with you their thoughts on education and concerns with Act 46. Where do you stand, Governor?
Act 46, I believe, is a great bill that's forming a partnership between local communities and the state to right-size our educational enterprise so that, number one, we improve quality, outcomes for kids. That's the most important thing. And secondly, we eventually get our property taxes under control because they're out of control. And there's going to be a lot of resistance. There always has been. But the beauty of Act 46 is that it really gives incentives to local communities to have a conversation, as Elmore has been doing and other communities, about what does make sense. And, you know, Elmore did vote down a more consolidated system. I think they're going to see triple-digit increases in their property taxes as a result. And I think it's probably a conversation that will continue to happen up there. But the state doesn't want to come in and tell you what to do. What Act 46 does very cleverly is give communities incentives for helping to have finally the conversation we need to have about the fact that we've got 20,000 fewer kids in our schools than we had just a couple of decades ago, that our school spending is the highest in the nation, that this isn't sustainable, and most frightening, forget the money, that we have some kids who are having their educational options limited because they are in such small systems. And what do I mean by that? Literally, if you look at small school boards, local control today, different from when I was a kid growing up in Vermont, when there were more and more kids in the schools, now local control means for school boards, year after year, what options, what opportunities do we take away from our kids to be able to pass this budget? Is it languages? Is it sports? Is it music program? Is it God knows what? And so if we do nothing, local control will mean more schools will close and kids will have fewer options, but it won't happen with planning and the conversation local communities about how do we get the best outcomes for our kids. I think that's what Act 46 is going to result in. That's what's happening around the state, conversations that I never dreamed would be happening at the level they are right now. So I say congratulations, local control, for joining us in admitting that our system's busted, that we've got to fix it, and that we're engaging with local communities so that they can come up with the right answers for their communities to solve the problem through that great thing that we call democracy.
As I mentioned, we are going to be talking on this program tomorrow about Act 46, a much larger discussion, including why some people, including lawmakers, have concerns about this. So if you want to ask about Act 46, carry on that conversation. Go to vpr.net. You can ask questions there. Governor, consider this the lightning round. I've got three questions for you
away,
in the next
Jane.
2 minutes.
I'm with you.
We have two listeners who would like you to explain your reasoning for endorsing Hillary Clinton, Maggie and Dennis, who will just say, why? Why not go for Senator Sanders?
Well, first of all, I'm incredibly proud of Bernie. I love Bernie. He's doing a great job, and I'm so glad he's in this race. He's giving Vermont, I can't give him enough kudos for the way he's running this race. My belief is that Hillary Clinton is the person who is most ready, capable, able, creative to take on the toughest job in the world, which is president of the United States. She's a pragmatic progressive that will get results.
Will you be endorsing any of the candidates who've already thrown their hat in the ring for your job?
I would not say no definitively, never, but I have no intention. This is what I'm excited about. The Democrats have great candidates running for governor, and it's incredibly heartening to have so many candidates who are so good running for the most important office in Vermont.
So three Democrats in the race and one member of your cabinet, Republican Phil Scott, but one of them may see your endorsement later on in the season?
I doubt it. Usually, you know, we just let the Democratic Party decide. Republicans do the same thing. Republicans, who's the best candidate? And then we, you know, we all get out and help them once they win the nomination.
Governor, you have in past legislative sessions and in past speeches, whether it's an inaugural address or a State of the State address, focused on one issue, one problem that you want to see tackled by the legislature and by the state, whether it's the payroll tax for closing the Medicaid reimbursement gap, education, Lake Champlain cleanup, heroin. Will we be seeing another focus from you this January for your last session?
My focus is going to be on continuing to make the change we need to make to not only create jobs, economic opportunity, continue the good progress we're making there, but all the issues that are going to help us continue to move Vermont forward. So I think you'll see me talking about a lot of topics.
Not a singular focus this year. That's Governor.
That's an exclusive. You get that first.
The exclusive is everything. Everything's on the table.
Everything important.
All right. Well, you heard it here first. Governor Peter Shumlin, thanks very much for talking
with us. Hey, thanks for having me. It's always fun.
So tomorrow we talked about Act 46, a law passed in the last legislative session that would streamline educational governance by merging the state's nearly 300 school districts into larger entities. Again, this provides tax incentives and other financial enticements to consolidate. But a lot of questions persist. There's vocal opposition to the law. Tomorrow, we'll look for clarification from lawmakers, and we'll hear why some have a problem with it. Vermont Edition's producers are Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. We have production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.